and a little history if I can. I'm kind of sitting back here relaxed, and I mentioned how we took our house down from Discovery to Atlin, the one that Dad and Mother built after. They looked after the place shortly after Dad lost his leg. Well, later years, this John Noland I spoke of, he was quite an ingenious sort of a chap, and we rigged up a big skid and a big bobsleigh, and we moved about a dozen houses, even the log cabin down from Discovery to Atlin, the 6 miles. We just moved it with one team of horses, and we had fair grades a bit, but we'd take and use drive points in the ground in the wintertime and put block and tackle on. Sometimes we had to use, like we'd put one block on a building, and then we'd put another block on the end of that line that was like what they call I can't think the name of it right now. A left hitch, I believe they call it. And you could move anything. Then when we came to the downhills, well, we'd always put something in the ground or snub it to a tree if there's any downhill. But you'd be surprised the buildings that we moved down with just a team of horses. And we sometimes cut them in half. The log, one big log building, we cut it in half and braced it. And we moved the hall that we had in Discovery. Moose Hall, that's right it was, Moose Hall. It was the Arctic Brotherhood in Discovery, and then they changed it to Moose Hall. And we moved that down in 3 sections, so had a little experience in that line. And I'm just jumping around here a little bit. I had made a few notes, but speaking back of when I went up on Wright Creek and mined with this old chap, there's some funny experiences I had there. I just, in this little cabin, and I don't think it had, I'm sure it didn't have a window in it. I've got a picture of my granddaughter and I 43 years later in front of it. It was taken, and I have it here. But I had one rather strange experience in that cabin. Well, first of all, when we moved in, all I had was just a few little poles. They'd be about inch and a half through for stretched or laid in there for the bed, and then a bunch of hay on top, you see, and a canvas, and that was my mattress. But anyway, this cabin was built into the hill a bit, and the back of it, you could step off the hillside pretty near on the roof. It wasn't very high in the first place. And this one time, and when we first went there in the spring, I got some mud, it looked like. Well, actually, it was ashes outside the building, and I took and I mudded the cabin to keep the wind out a bit, because we didn't have much to chink it with. I mudded the cabin to keep the wind out a bit to make it a little livable. And taking this ash, I didn't realize that there might be some urine had been on it, and there would be a little salt in it. But anyway, this one time, while staying there, I went back up. I had cut a bunch of wood and just run the axe down. They call it rosset, and stood it on end. Then I was going to pack in some that night, and I walked up a half a mile behind the cabin, and I saw this great big bear track, as big as a dinner plate. Well, I wasn't feeling too sure about things. Came back that night, kind of on edge, I guess, and the only light I had was an old carbide lamp that I picked up, and I had a little carbide down the creek somewhere or other, and I had a rifle, 30-30, Savage. And I had a little bit of bacon, I think, hanging on the ridgepole in the cabin. Well, I went to bed that night, and by George, I heard something out the back. Well, I lay there, and I tried not to breathe, and was scared stiff, I don't mind telling you. I had the gun loaded beside me, but I thought, all a bear needs to do is take one swipe and take the roof off the cabin, and I'm right there. Well, I finally went to sleep anyhow. I went out next morning, sort of sandy out the back of the cabin, and here it was, rabbits, they were licking away at this mud there that there's a little salt in from people urinating on it, I guess. That's all it was, but I was sure a scared man. That's one of the times that I was really scared when I was out like that. Speaking again of when I came back after having the rheumatic fever, you know, it was a wonderful thing in the fall of the year to get out and be able to hunt again. I remember the first grouse that I shot. Why, I just held the gun up and shot for the middle of them. I brought them home, and poor Ruth, she cleaned them, and she said, well, she said, they were pretty rough, she said, Charlie. She says, any more you bring home like that, will you shoot? Any more you bring home like that, will you clean them yourself? I said, fine. Well, the first time, of course, it was quite a thrill, and I kind of got a little more confidence in myself. And the next time I went out, and from then on, truthfully, I was quite a good shot from shooting gophers as a kid. I shot them in the head all the time, so I got away from that all right, anyhow. Another thing that came to mind was when we were up on this Boulder Creek where we're staying, and I worked for the Consolidated. That's after I had the rheumatic fever and before I had it. There was an old chap up there, an old Norwegian, Mark Edwardson, and when the first year we were married, why, I took and used his dogs one time in the winter, and I had real good dogs, and he was kind of a little jealous of my dogs, I guess, poor old Mark, anyhow, you know, poor fellow, but he's a good old chap. But while I had this rheumatic fever, I left the dogs up at the camp and was in town for a week or so, and the fellow was looking after them. They were quite a ways from the camp, but anyway, why, Mark came home this night, and he had quite a few beer. He walked up, and the dogs were howling, and I'm just ahead of my story a little bit. When I came back in the spring and I got my dogs, I saw this big dog, Bob, had a tooth knocked out, you see, and I didn't know a thing about it for a year after. But anyway, apparently Mark told me after, a long time after, he said, Charlie, he said, I've killed Wolverine, he said, with a club in a trap, and he trapped a lot out around Teslin, but he said, you know, he said, I want to tell you, that big dog of yours, he came close to getting me. Apparently, Mark must have been drunk when he came home. I knew dogs were on a long chain on a side hill, and it was quite rocky. And by George, when Mark went after the dog with the club, the dog backed up, this big Bob. He backed up. It's the end of his chain. And when Mark swung at him, he missed him. And the dog got him, and he got him by the hand. And Mark showed me the scar he had on his hand. And they rolled down the hill together. And Mark said if it hadn't been for some loose rocks the dog had dug loose, why, he might have killed him, he said. He said, by George, he said, that dog had me, really, and I was just about ready to pass out, and I got a hold of a big rock, and he says, I pounded him on the head, he says, until he let go. And that's when he broke the tooth, I guess. I guess he knocked the dog out. But that's some of the funny experiences you have. Poor old Mark. He's a good old fellow, really, too. I'm going to tell you about just a day or two after we were married, I took Ruth out. This was supposed to be our honeymoon. We took a little pack and we walked 12 miles out of town. And there was three brothers in there, Swedes, Charlie Hill, Shorty Hill, and a fellow Conrad Johnson. He changed his name, but he's still a brother. Well, they built a cabin up this 4th of July Valley where there was going to be a mine, and practically it was a mine a few times, but it didn't turn out. Still fooling around with it. It would be a silver lead mine. Well, they thought they were going to go big, and they built, at the end of this McDonald Lake, was on the road up, and they built a cabin there. They were going to have a lodge or something. They didn't have any idea, but they're going to have a lodge, and they built a two-story. Well, Ruth and I walked out there this day to see old Charlie Hill. Well, he had been quite a drinker, but he was on the wagon as far as I knew, I thought. But the road crew had been working out there, and he made a bunch of beer. And I guess the road crew didn't buy it. When I got out there, here he was at the top of the stairs. He had a stairway and a door down the front end, and he had a door cut out the back, but nothing there yet. Been living in it for some time, and he saw me there coming up with Ruth, and he says, oh, Charlie, he says, and you've got your missus, he says, why didn't you let me know ahead? He says, come on in. Well, we wanted to sleep in the base, in the lower part, where it wasn't finished, just on a mattress and get away from them. Well, we come on up. I got lots of grub. Well, we went up, you know, and he'd been on a drunk for a while, and you never saw such a mess in your life. He says, I got lots of fish. Well, he had a bunch of fish in a pail in the kitchen filled off. Well, they were just slime. They were rotten. I opened the back door, and I just threw them out. And we had towels with us and everything, Ruth and I, and a little grub. And I had shot some grouse on the way up. So I cleaned the grouse, and I got a little fire going. He didn't have any wood. And I said, well, Charlie, I said, you go out and cut some wood now. So he went out the back, and we looked at him out the back, and he had, there was a few blown down jackpine there, and he'd been cutting the ends off them. They were dry. And here he has his saw, and he'd stagger ahead with a 6-foot saw and stagger back, you know. Finally, he come in. He says, "Charlie, could I have another beer?" So I said, "Sure, it's your beer, Charlie." But I said, "Straighten up." So I went out. I said, "Well, I'll go out and cut some wood with you." So we went out, and we got some wood. Anyway, well, then we had supper. It came to going to bed, and gee whiz, the darn little shack he had, the front room would be about 12 feet wide and about 14 feet long, and he had a little single bed in it and a sleeping robe and mattress, but the sleeping robe was black as you could think of. And he wanted Ruth to sleep in that, and him and I were going to sleep on the floor. Well, I said, "Oh, no, we'll sleep on the floor." He wouldn't let us sleep below, so we slept on the floor on a mattress there just with our clothes on. And all night long, every once in a while, he'd wake up and he'd say, "Oh, my God, if the people in Atlin ever find out that I let a woman sleep on the floor and I slept in the bed, poor old Charlie." He was quite a character. So we took, and oh, that evening, he says, "Well," he says, "I'll tell you," he says, "you go up on the mountain," he says, "and get some moose," and he said, "I'll work them the hillside here and get some blue grouse." And poor Ruth, she said to me quietly, she says, "You think I'm going to stay around with that guy?" "Why," she says, "she got another thought coming." Well, I wouldn't blame her. But anyway, Ruth and I hiked up the mountain, and I saw 5 moose, and there was 2 big bulls, and I saw a big cow there, and I missed her the first couple of shots, but I got her, and then Ruth packed the liver, and I blazed the trail out, and gee whiz, we walked back that night to Charlie's place that afternoon, and we walked in that evening to 12 miles, and Ruth was just right out of an office, you might say, and some swamp we had to go over. She stayed in bed the next day. I got a little horse, and I went up, and I hooked the whipple tree on the horse and hiked up and had a little feed with him. And that horse was little white foam on him. I was in good shape when I got up top of the mountain. I hooked on, pulled the moose out, and got it home that night. So that was a part of a pretty rough honeymoon for her anyhow. Since I wrote you, why, I've been down to Reno for... took 2 days to go down with the bus, and 2 days back I went down with another old chap and that, and I met a few friends, but I'm inclined to gamble a little bit. I played the slot machines pretty heavy, dollar machines, and put a few, yes, I guess $200 or $300 in, but I got a little back. I played blackjack after, but I don't think I'm anxious to do that kind of gambling again. It's kind of a change. I'll tell you, we've got this election coming up, and I'll fill you in on the election when I before I finish this tape, but I just got so tired of listening to the TV with this election, and they come up with such terrible yarns that you can't believe any, so I just thought I'd get away for a little bit. So I've got some other little notes I made about some old-timers that are quite interesting, I hope, to you, so I'm going to reach over and get them. Yes, this next story I've got it in a book, I think it's Jack London, and the heading is different short stories, and the story is Unexpected, is what this is. And this Mrs. Nelson and her husband, they took, four men, Nelson and 3 men, and she cooked for them, and they worked below Juneau in the real early days, that's up on the coast. And they mined that summer, and they took out a fair amount of money, and I think they had about $5,000 left in gold, and they were going to prospect that winter. Well, Mrs. Nelson and Mr. Nelson lived in, I've got the story, and I'll be glad to show it to you sometime, or get a photostatic copy of it. But anyway, they lived in this house, and she cooked for them, and these other 3 fellas were there, and they worked the biggest part of the winter and didn't find anything, and apparently one of them got a little bit sultry, I guess, and quiet, and the 2 men come in for breakfast one morning, and she says, "Well, where's Nels?" And they said, "He'll be in a minute." He stepped through the door with a shotgun, and he shot the 2 at the table. And she was English and a husky woman, and she grabbed the gun, and her husband, old Hans, he was a Pennsylvania Dutchman, he got over there and helped her slowly, and they held him for quite a while tied up, and they couldn't get any communication. There was just a few Indians around there and about 10 feet of snow. So they kept him for quite a while, and then they had sort of an Indian chief come over, and he started to look after, help them to look after him, to guard him. And this Indian wasn't so stupid. This fellow that shot them, he says, look, he says, if you let me go, he says, I'll give you half the gold. Well, the Indian figured that if I let him go, why, he'll shoot me too. So the Indian, he told Nelson's. So the Nelsons had decided they'd have to hang him. And I don't remember the exact figures, but I've got the book here. And Mrs. Nelson wouldn't shove the box out from under him, so she says, well, I'll help you, or something to that effect. And they hung him. And then when the snow went off and that, they got to Juneau, and they got some names of some Indians, and she had to report to authorities a bit. Well, I knew the lady real well. They came to Atlin, and they worked on Spruce Creek. Pardon me, they worked on Wright Creek with a fellow named Johnson for a little bit, one summer. Then they moved over to Spruce, and they started a little store eventually. And Mother used to visit her, and I've got pictures of her on her 93rd birthday. In fact, Ruth and I used to go and visit them. They moved out after many, many years. They moved out to just over the border in the States, and Mother and Ruth and us used to go and visit her and knew them quite well. But this is quite a true story, and she was a wonderful person. I could tell you some real stories, but I don't want to go on about it. Oh, we had some real, real characters. And I mentioned, I think, about this Davy Hall one time when I logged out that way. Well, Davy, he was trained as a journalist in England, great little fellow, but he didn't believe in any work. And he lived a few miles out of town there. He had horses first, and they finally died off from starvation. He didn't have enough feed for them, and he had a few cattle at the last. But the time we went out to log out there, we stayed and cut a bunch of wood first for him to haul into town to sell to the liquor store. It was dry wood, the fire had been through before. We stayed there. I remember when we stayed there, though. Well, he's a wonderful little guy, really. He'd sing like everything, too, and he'd never get up in the morning when we weren't there. But anyway, why, this Jack Tatton that was with me, he was a partner of Davy's. He was a nephew of Davy's, and Davy and him had come up the coast from Vancouver to Atlin. It took them 2 years to get up, and they stopped on the Queen Charlotte Islands over a winter. And anyway, Davy, he was quite a fellow. But anyway, I laughed when we were there. Why, when he'd come home with the horses, first little bit there, he'd take the hames off the horses. There was so much manure in the barn, he couldn't get them in. So in the evening, I'd go out with a coal oil lantern and chop the barns out and clean them out. And we stuck around with him until we got this wood cut. And we got a bunch of wood in him for him for the winter, the poor fella. And then we moved into a tent and stayed in a 10-by-12 tent all winter. We built few logs around the side, and we had a little stove and a little cook stove in there. Tatton did most of the cooking, slept on the floor. I'd get the wood and water and one thing and another. We had to melt snow for water. So that's a little more of my experiences with these old chaps. There was another old chap there that was a wonderful old chap. His name was Hudson Calvert. I may have mentioned this already, I don't know, but he was a Texan, a great big old hook nose, and he shot moose there and sold it in the summertime, and I used to go out with him with the horse and bring it in and one thing or another. But I hope I didn't mention this before, but anyway, the trappers used to gather at this cabin in Discovery. They'd come in from Teslin and that, and these Lemieux boys, they were two French fellows, very fine fellows. They had a mink ranch out at Gladys Lake, and they had a cabin and a corral for dogs. And I used to go down, and whenever they'd come into town, I'd go down and start a fire in the heater and get some water and put a big wide-mouthed bucket in to warm the water up. And then they'd chop up some moose meat and cut little squares of moose hair, about an inch square, and throw it in with the moose to keep the worms out of the dogs. They said it cleaned them out. But anyway, this night, this George Geddes was there, and he was married to, I kidded Mother about him after. He was Scotchman. He was married to an Indian woman. She was a good woman, all right enough. And he had this, he was getting ready to go to bed, and he had this robe that he brought out, and it was a big Hudson Bay blanket, and it had the backs of gophers on it, sewed together with sinew. And I made the little remark that I said, gee whiz, I said, I'd be a long time getting enough gophers, because I was shooting gophers for fox feed, but I wasn't shooting them in the head, I was shooting them in the middle and getting down the hole. And I said, it'd be a long time getting any gophers for a robe like that. An old text, he says, when I shoot at a gopher, he never goes down the hole. And I snickered a little bit, and boy, oh boy, he looked at me, and he says, I don't talk enough to lie, and I apologize plenty, you know? I went out the next day, and I thought, well, I know he's telling the truth. If he can do it, why can't I? And that is how I learned to shoot, and I was a crack shot myself. So that's just one of the funny little things that goes through a person, or happens to a person in life. So I'll see now about another old chap, Hans Gunderson, in a minute. Yes, speaking of this Hans Gunderson, he was a Norwegian, and he went up there in the early days, and he'd been on the ship, sailing ships, I guess, but he didn't know anything about horses, and he got a couple of big Clyde horses, old Charlie and Frank. Charlie was a great big horse, old Frank was an old swayback. But anyway, he never put a load on those horses, and he had them for years, but we used to, as kids, teased him a lot, and he would get worked up so fast. A very loud spoken sort of a man anyhow. I remember this one night, this Matthew Mark Buckpit I mentioned before was a teacher. Well, this one time we'd got a nice snow, and it was quite soft and rolled up good big balls, and us kids got together, and we thought we'd take and roll up a bunch of balls and got them on sleighs. And where the teacher lived, he had a little bit of a shed in front of the door there, just the one door, but there's sort of a shed built in front. And we thought, well, if we get these balls up there and pile them in front of the door, he'd have to come out a window and we'd make a real mess of it. And we were having a great time, as we thought. Well, you know, up in that country, you have your outhouses. Well, it just happened that Buckpit was out in the outhouse, and he waited till we got them all piled in there, you know, and we're laughing like everything. And he came out of there, and he's big laugh, too. He says, well, he says, yeah, what do you say we take them somewhere else? So the only place we could think of was old Hans Gunderson. So I went to Ward Kilpatrick, the postman, and I said, say, I said, would you like to see Hans? He said, matter of fact, I would. So we went up the other end of town, told Hans the Ward wanted to see him. We piled the snow up against his door, you see, and that. And there was somebody inside there, but we piled it up so fast they couldn't get out anyhow. And old Hans, he came home, he was really raving, you see. So he went over to this, Albert Miller was one of the boys, and he went over to the Miller place, and they were up on a sort of a side hill, and they had a few steps down. At the bottom of the steps, they had a fence, and we thought we'd put when he was up there complaining, we thought we'd put a wire across the bottom of the gate, you see. And then Buckpit, he says, well, gee whiz, if he trips on that, there's quite a drop off ahead here. He said he might really hurt himself, so we put the wire up on top of the gate, you see. So old Hans, he comes out, and he says, well, he says, you know, Mrs. Miller, we got to do something about these boys. He says, he's kind of swore a bit at times too, but he says, we got to do something. They're a real nuisance. And he was trying to be quite a lady. He's quite a ladies' man at times. So he comes down, you know, and he's talking to her, and he's coming down sideways in the dark, and he jabs his middle into this wire, you see, that we had up high, and he let out this yell. He says, hell me God, he says, the skyscrapers are going to get me yet. I'll never forget that as long as we wouldn't have got caught. We got laughing. We went too far away. We had to keep quiet or he'd caught us. He could run like mad. He pretty near caught us a few times. So that's poor old Hans. But he was a wonderful man. He got rid of those horses. Finally, one of them he had to shoot, and the other died. And then he married this Mrs. Evans. I mentioned her on another tape of yours before. And she was a little Welsh woman in a big family, and he was no good. And he married her at a late age, and he worked. He never worked before, and he just barely got by. In fact, he used to come up the back of the buildings and get hay for me to feed his horses. And Dad was always saying, what are you wasting all the hay on? I was scared to tell Dad. But he was a wonderful old man. By George, I take my hat off to old Hans. He built a cabin in town there, a big place, you know, and looked after the old lady as long as he was alive. So that's another old-timer that we've covered. I see I have two little notes together, and one's about an old ager. Old ager was a sort of a remittance man from England, I guess, and he lived down what they call Indian River, about 20 miles out of town, and there was a big Frenchman lived near there too, but we'll go on to Ager first. And Ager lived down there, and he cut a little bit of hay, and he had a fortress built all around his place. He had like two fences and gravel between, and he lived, it was real gravel, and he lived in the ground. I remember this Frank Henning, a friend of mine, went out to see him about getting some hay, and he the old rifle came up first. He was a real odd guy, old ager, but he'd get his remittance in the summertime when the hotel was going in Atlin there, and he'd come in, and I guess he washed up. I didn't get close to him, but he'd had these old ragged clothes. Yes, he had these old ragged clothes. I got a phone call there in the middle, and that's how I got cut off here a little bit. He had these old ragged clothes, and he'd put on quite a show, you know. He'd wander around there like he was a millionaire. It was quite a deal. But and also, speaking of in that area, Indian River, it was this Labadeer. It was a big Frenchman there, and he had horses, and he raised a lot of horses. And when the Alaska Highway went in, why, he did manage to get, he had a bunch of them put on the highway, and he got a little bit ahead there. But he raised a wonderful garden. He had lots of manure, I guess, from the horses and that from the barn. And when the lake would raise, he had that sort of sandy soil, and when the lake would raise, the moisture would come into this garden, and he raised the greatest carrots and parsnips that you ever saw, and he used to sell them like everything. They were good, clean vegetables. But in regard to him again, I want to tell, there was this old Pete Gabriel and the fellow Nat Monroe. They were down helping him one time to build a cabin. No, pardon me, they were building a barn. And they were off working on the barn, and in his cabin, he was hooked up to telegraph line, just like I spoke to you. We were hooked on telegraph line when I was logging down the lake. Well, he had one permanent hooked up there all the time, and he could hear everything that was going through. But he looked over at the cabin, and here a black bear was going in the cabin. There's two rooms in the cabin, and Pete Gabriel and Monroe both told me about it. But anyway, the bear went in the cabin, and it started tearing things to pieces in the cabin. And Labadeer, he had nerve enough. He got in that cabin when that black bear was there, and he got his Ross rifle. That's what he said he had. He got the Ross rifle down, and he shot the bear right there in the cabin. He was quite a character. Oh, he couldn't read to speak of. He was quite, but he was a gruff, a good old guy, though, just the same. He told me another time he had foxes there, too, you see, and he told me one time he heard the foxes yelping, and he looked out, and here was a big grizzly out there alongside the pen, and he opened the door to go out to shoot it, and here was a grizzly right in front of the door. He says, I pumped a few shells at it, and he come in, and he says, I just shook like a leaf. He says, I couldn't hit the walls of the cabin, but the other bear, I guess, left, but he did drag the... He had quite a time getting the horse up to it, and he dragged the grizzly away. But there was some pretty rough old characters there. Another fella I must tell you about, he was quite a character. Old Tom Keeler was his name, and he didn't work much. He worked the odd time in the summer, and in the wintertime, why, there was a John Jack, and he was an Indian. He was a chief, a wonderful, great big fellow, wonderful chap. And he had a horse in the summertime, and he'd leave the horse with old Tom and give Tom a little money and feed to feed the horse in the wintertime. Tom, he'd lived on rabbits, and, of course, he was quite a character. And he acted quite queer at times. He'd come down, and when the dogs would bark at him, he'd squat down, and he had a mustache and blow at them and scare heck out of them. And us kids used to get quite a kick out of him. Well, anyway, as time went on, I was up there one time, and he told me, he says, they think, he says, that I'm crazy, but he says, I'm going to fool them all. And he gave me a double-barreled shotgun that time. And by George, maybe it was the next spring, I was going up, and I thought I'd see if I could get a swan, and it was in April, early April, and I got on a horse, on horseback, and I was just going out of Discovery, around the bend, and he rushes up to me, walked fast, he was an old man, walked almost a trot. He came up and he shook hands with me, he says, well, good luck to you, boy, when you grow up. Well, I was dumbfounded, and I went on up, and I didn't get a swan, and I came back, and there was a big hullabaloo in Discovery. Tom had come into town, and he went through, and there was this same Conrad Johnson and John Joseph and a bunch had a cabin at the end of town. They were mining there in the summer, and they had a bunch of gold nugget chains and that on a table, and he went into their place, and he threw the gold in the stove, and he says, this is for the devil or something, and he walked up on top of the hill going towards Atlin, walked back and forth across the road, and so they took and phoned down, and the policeman, old Bob Webster, coal oil Bob, he used to peddle coal oil in Discovery, or in Vancouver before he was a policeman, a great old guy, but anyway, Webster, he come up and took Keeler to town. So they were taking them out to send them to the asylum. Well, they had to come out with dogs, and by George, old John Williams was the liquor store man. John Williams went with Webster, and they're taking Tom Keeler out. And they took him all the way to Carcross with dogs, because the ice was going then. And this fellow, oh, gee, I know, Paul Tingley was the fellow's name. I knew him. He was a Teamster. Paul was telling about it. He told everybody. He says, well, I walked down, he says, and old Tom Keeler is sitting in the dog sleigh. And he says, I says, Tom, I says, hey, Tom, I said, I thought they were bringing a crazy man out. Tom says, yes, they were. He was running behind. Well, off the tape there. And this Walter Owen was in charge of the asylum out there. And Mother, and Ruth had put this Atlin picnic on for years here. And Owen was at the Atlin picnic. And Mother says, how about Tom Keeler? She says, well, Tom, he says, Tom, don't worry about Tom. He took up shoemaking, and he does a little shoemaking in the wintertime, and he disappears every summer, and he comes back every fall. So that gives you the rundown on Tom Keeler.
They think I'm crazy, but I'll show you. And by God, he got up and played.
I'll tell you about another old chap. This fellow named Ben Nickel, and he was interested in a mine just across from Atlin Lake on the other lake there. And he had a great big mustache, and he was quite a ladies' man, you know. He was around town there. But this one time, this John Noland had bought this boat, about a 30-foot boat, and it was tied up. He just bought it, and he was taking a hunting party out. He used to run people down the glacier with this boat. Anyway, he was taking a hunting party out, and he left it tied up. Well, the first radio they got in Atlin was at the Kootenai Hotel, and the different people, businesses, donated toward buying it. And they said they had to have a real good ground for it. Well, the hotel was about a block from the lake, and they decided they'd dig a wire into the ground and run it right down alongside of this wharf where this boat was tied up, and they drove a great big bar down. Well, old Noland, I guess he... Well, old Noland, I guess he didn't realize the bar was there, and they got a real storm up, and it punched a hole in this boat, and she sank. Well, this old Clarence Sands, I've mentioned him before, maybe, he was a wonderful big English chap, and had a store, a wonderful chap. And always, he wasn't a great one to get out and do a lot himself, but he could manage to get things and going, and he phoned the people up, and I think I've told you this before, I'm not sure. But anyway, he phoned them up, and he got them all together, and he says, I bought a case of beer, and he had them pull this up. And they pulled it up by hand with block and tackle and put a bit of a ways underneath it partway up and bailed it out. Well, it was quite a night for the town. And old Ben Nickel, they took and they shaved his mustache off, and I think half of it, and painted the other with ink. And boy, he was going to sue them like everything. But the next day in town, I'm sure he told you this, the next day why Mrs. Henning saw him in town, told him how good he looked without it, and he was fine from then on. I'm sure I told you that, but anyway, why... That is that. Poor old, going on to another chap, Norman Fisher. He was around many years, ran the mail, different places, ran it to Telegraph Creek and everything. And he was telling me one time he was going through in the early fall, and boy, oh boy, it'll snow. And he stepped on the edge of a bear trap, and it threw him up in the air. And he'd just come back from the First World War. He said, if I'd seen that fella, he said, I'd have killed him dead. He was really a kick. Another time, myself, when I was hunting, and it was very cold. I went out, and it turned real cold, and I just had a fly, and I built a wall in front, and I built the fire so that the wall would throw the heat towards this fly I had up. And I froze both ears that night. The darn fur cap worked off as it was there. But I couldn't hunt anything. I had a what they call a 30 U.S. Army. It's a short carbine gun, like a heavy gun, like heavier than a 30-30, and a lot of metal. Had hanging over my shoulder, and I had heavy Stanfield underwear on, and by George, you know, it started to burn my skin almost. I didn't know how cold it was, but it was 56 below, a fella told me, a few miles from there that night. But I had to give up because a moose could hear you miles off, you see, when you're hunting like that. I hooked the dogs up to come to town that night. Dogs hadn't anything to eat for a day or two, and in the meantime, where my snowshoe trail was, they had put some horses over my snowshoe trail, and I couldn't run behind the dog sleigh, so I had to sit in. I nearly froze, but on the way in, I lost a black snake and an axe. And the fellow named Turnquist, he came in the next day, and he asked people around who had been out that way, and he picked the axe and this some black snake whip up, and he gave it to me. People were honest as could be those days, you know.
Sure.
Yes, and I remember another instance that really upset me. I think I may have told you about this Harry Marshall he was a sea captain at one time, and him and his brother and I think three other partners, they started up. They heard about the gold rush, and they started up, and I think it took them 2 years to get there, and he mentioned the little horse he had and everything, and I found his diary, and when I left there, it pack rats had been on it, and I threw it away, and because it stunk so bad, but I would give $1,000 for that today, because it was written in ink, and he was a well-educated man, and he wrote every day down on it. Poor old Harry, you know. So I think I've covered that pretty well now, so I may go find something else here. Oh, yes. I had a little notation here on another chap. It was Tom Webb and Bert Bruner. They were two prospectors, and they trapped in the wintertime, and I knew them both as a small boy, and I've seen the picture. These Hennings old-timers, they have a picture of Tom Webb with his head all bandaged up. That's what brought it to mind. Anyway, they were out prospecting in the south end of Atlin Lake, and a black bear came along, and they rattled their pan. They thought, never even thought about it having cubs, and she took after them, and by George, Bert Bruner, Tom Webb got up a tree, and Bert Bruner wasn't going to make it, and Tom Webb thought, boy, that she was going to get his partner, and Tom Webb jumped down off the tree, and he took a pick, and he went after the bear for a bit, and Bert Bruner got up the tree all right enough. By Jiminy, Tom Webb turned around, run for the tree, but he didn't make it. And she broke a tooth off in his head. And I remember well when Mother and Jean and I were walking around the bend in the road just above Discovery, and he was coming down with his head all bandaged up. And he had the tooth, and he showed it to us. And it was quite the thing. And then the two of them, they went out trapping that winter, and they were both out hunting in a snowstorm. And Bert Bruner, he saw something moving in the bush, and he pulled up quite a ways off, and I'm sure it wasn't murder. He pulled up, and he shot. And boy, he killed the man that saved his life. He killed Tom Webb, and he came to town, and he was in a terrible state. And he left the country, and nobody ever heard from him. I don't know whether he took his life or not, but I know he was in terrible shape about it. Sure. So that's a little more. Sure. Speaking of our teachers, I remember this Buck Pitt, Matthew Mark Brandon Buck Pitt, and he was quite a character. He'd always just full of the devil, you know. I mentioned him before about the snowballs, but anyway, different times he'd take us kids up, and old Billy Morrison was an old Scotchman, he's kind of cranky old guy, and we didn't have coppers. We never used coppers there. It was all 5 cents, and 5 cents was pretty damn small, I thought. So Buck Pitt would take, and he'd send one kid in, the kid would get a 5 cents worth of candy, and just this old Morrison put it on the counter, and a kid would grab it and say, next fellow will pay for it. And well, boy, by the time about 10 kids went in and they kept saying, next fellow would pay for it, old Billy was ready to grab them. I think about the last kid went in and he grabbed him, Buckpit would go in and pay for the whole thing, but he was here a kick. And this other teacher we had up there, his name was Rudyard Kipling. I think it was after Buck Pitt, I think. I'm not sure either after or before. No, it was before Buck Pitt's time, I believe. Anyway, Rudyard Kipling, and he was his first school, and he was red-headed and that and hot-headed, and I know he strapped me a couple of times for things that didn't amount to anything, and it didn't bother me any. But I used to take, and when he'd say something, I'd just twist it around something awful, you know, and give him a real bad time. And he used to say, you just can twist everything up something awful. I did it just for devilment. I wasn't the best, I guess. But anyway, I was over in Hawaii a few years back and sitting at the counter there having a cup of tea, and it was raining a little bit. And I said to this lady next door, I said, well, a little mist here, but I said, it's warm. It's not like Vancouver. Oh, yes, she says, but we're in from Victoria. It's better in Victoria. I said, I believe it is better in Victoria, the weather. But I said, where I came from, I said, there'd be snow. And she says, the prairies? No, I said, a little place called Atlin, B.C. Well, this fellow was sitting on the other side of her, and he looked down, and, well, he says, I left Atlin in 1923, I think it was. And boy, I couldn't figure out what was up, you know. And I looked up and I see that he had a hat on and one thing and another, and finally he looked down and he says, when he said he'd left there in 23, I said, well, hell, I should know you. That's exactly what I said. And he looked down after a minute or two. He says, say, you couldn't be Charlie Gairns. And I didn't answer him. And I got off and I went up alongside of him and I slapped him on the back and I says, Rudyard Kipling was his name. I says, well, by golly, Kip, I says, this is a great day. And there's quite a few people there having something to eat. But I spoke up. I says, it's 53 years since we saw each other. And I lifted the back of his hat up a little bit, and he still had some hair. And I says, by God, Kip, you wouldn't have that hair yet if you were teaching me, would you? And everybody laughed like everything. But we got around together, and I saw him. But he's passed on since. But he was in Victoria on Toronto Street. But we had a great time together. But I guess I'm kind of a character myself. I'm taking it fairly easy the last little bit. I guess I mentioned to you that I had that prostate operation. Well, it's not doing too bad, but it's kicked up a little bit, one or two things that haven't been just right. But it's not too bad, and I'm going to see the doctor in a day or two, but I'm fine. And Bob Campbell and Jean, they're having their 50th anniversary on the 25th, and Harry and Dave, that's my two boys, are coming down with their wives, and I think they're going to have about 40 people there. But poor Jean, she won't know anything about what's going on because she's got this Alzheimer's and blind. But we'll be going over there on Saturday. And I guess tomorrow is our big day of election here, where whether we have free trade with the United States or not. Or the Liberals are against it, of course, and it's the Conservatives are free trade. And I was glad to get away to Reno for a little bit. I got awful tired because they can't tell a word of truth, some of these people that are electioneering and that. So I guess I'll get out in the morning and vote. Don't make any bones about it. I'm going to vote for free trade. But Harry and them and different people. Harry was down and there was some engineers here and that. And it was quite an interesting discussion, pros and cons and one thing and another. And they figured free trade was the best. And so I guess I'll go along with the rest of them. I'm not an authority on things, but I'll do as they're doing, I think. So anyway, I'm going to cut it off for tonight, and I'm going to replay this whole thing and see how it sounds, and then we'll finish the tape up and hope to get it over to you before Christmas. We'll finish the tape up and hope to get it over to you before Christmas. Yes, I just replayed the whole tape, and I noticed that I said a case of beer. It was a case of whiskey, because they couldn't get drunk on a case of beer, a whole bunch of fellas. Yeah, so I'm going to cut it off now for now. Well, here I am another day. I just happened to think about a fellow in bed last night. Joey Unitas was his name, and he came from Oregon. I believe he had a bar down there, and he came up and he started a fox ranch about 12 miles from Discovery, and we used to deliver groceries to him. But he was a real rugged, he was a Russian, a little heavy set fella, and he built up a regular fort there for keeping his foxes, put these big poles on end. I saw it years later, and a lot of people were wondering what it was. They didn't know what it was. But anyway, then he tried farming for a little bit on just below there, and we'd get our hay from him, and he had a phone. We could phone him up from town, and he'd say, oh, he had lots of hay baled. Well, I'd go up there, you know, and boy, oh boy, he didn't have any hay baled, and he had a pretty rough set up there, just a big log the horses pulled with block and tackle down on top, and the bales would be about 3 foot square. But he had me baling hay with him all day, and I remember one time he said, well, come on over and have something to eat. So I went over with him, and he had a 45-gallon drum. He had a cabin sort of built in the hill, and then there was a tunnel in from the cabin where he kept chickens in the back. 45-gallon drum there, and he had it flattened off on top, and he had a fire on there, and he brought this flat pan out, and he had a few little small potatoes that he had cooked, and rabbits, and he warmed them up, and he sat on one side and I sat on the other, and that's the way we ate. And he opened the front door to let the chickens come out of this cellar at the back to run through, so you can imagine what kind of a place it was. I remember another time I was up there and getting hay. I think I just got loose hay that time, but that's right, it was loose hay. And I had a rack. Well, I thought I'd go and get a couple of rabbits. And he was raising pigs there, and he snared a lot of rabbits for pig feed. And he also snared moose, too. But anyway, I thought I'd go and get a rabbit or two. And I hiked across the field, and he must have had a pair of field glasses or something, because when I come back, he kind of joked. He says, "Well, that's I guess they got my rabbits out of the snare." I said, "Joe, I shot the rabbit." "I did. I shot the rabbit in his snare. It was alive." Anyway, while I was doing that, when I came back, why, he kind of kidded me a little bit about it. I had the rabbit. And we came back to Discovery, and this girl was staying with Jean. Mother and Dad were in Atlin looking after the store for a day or two, and my coat was hanging on the rack at the front, and she says, "Here, Charlie, I'll take your coat in. I'm going to get in touch with her this year. She's in Oregon, and I'm going to get some tapes." But anyway, she took my coat. "Gee," she says, "it's heavy," and she reached in the pocket, and that old son of a gun, he'd put a dead gopher in each pocket. He was a real character if there ever was one. Yes, and anyway, I'm giving a kind of history in regard to him. We mined on Birch Creek, partners. I think I mentioned mining there in 37 and 38. But anyway, we went down to his place, this Turi Matz and I, one of the partners, went down one day, and we were phoning into town to get some food up, groceries and that, and I was on the phone, and Turi says, "I wonder what Joe's living on now," and he lifted the lid off the pot, and here's a rabbit in there, eyes, head, and all. He was the roughest man you ever... It was a gray. And by golly, old Joe, he snared that gray, and he snared another little horse called Star, the two of them that I know of, and it was all hushed up, of course, anyhow, but he was quite a character. But he was good lots of ways. When we mined there, of course, he wanted us down in there when they had the big runoff of water, and he wanted us down to help him. Well, we had to use that water ourselves, and we couldn't spare the time. But he didn't hold it against us. I remember one time I was up there, and he was taking a cut-up, a ditch, big ditch, and he never used powder. He'd build a fire and put a tin on top, and on top of the rock, and then throw cold water on. So he was a real rugged chap. And then he came to Atlin. Well, he got involved with this Noland, and he got $30,000 out of a mine that he was with Noland. Came to Atlin, and he moved the old jail that was in Discovery. It was made out of 2x6s, and moved it and lived in that, right close to us. We had him over for dinner. He was pretty rough at Christmas. We'd have him over and the likes of that, but he thought the world and all of Ruth, and I remember we left and we came back for a trip in 1950, and he had a fantastic garden, and he wouldn't give anybody anything, and he said to us as soon as we went in, "Everything is yours in the garden, help yourself," and he wanted us to take a store over. He'd even finance us. He wanted us to stay there. He was a great old fellow, but anyway, I must remember this too. After the war, it would be early part of the war, he got a truck in. Well, he never could drive a truck. So we had the priest used to drive the truck a bit. Well, Joe had 52 lots in Atlin. He bought up everything. If he'd have lived, why, gee, he'd have been a millionaire out of all the property he'd bought. But anyway, he had all these lots in Atlin, and he wanted, and his truck, and he wanted the priest to take him up to Birch Creek, would be about, 8 to 10 miles. Well, the priest, he happened to meet Mrs. Roxburgh, an old-timer there, and Jenny Easton, and he says, "I'm taking Joe's truck this afternoon for up the creek. Would you like to come for a ride?" And he didn't ask Joe. Well, boy, he pulled up to Joe's place, and he had these two women. Joe's face got blushed up, and he jumped in the back, and he was mad. And he was leaving everything to the church up to then. By God, he had a fella in. Changed his will that night. The church lost out on that, but poor old Joel, he was quite a character. When I left there in 42, the fall of 42, I had a place there, a nice house I'd built, and it was a four-room place, and another fellow and I dug the basement and built it, my partner, and built it and moved in 30 days. But I worked long hours on it, of course, but anyway, I sold it to a fella. Harper Reed was his name. He was an English chap, a good fellow, but a little sharp-spoken. I got along fine with him. Harper, he bought the place anyhow. He was the Indian agent for years, and they always said, The joke was an Indian never died when he was Indian agent. He always got the treaty money, but I don't know if it's true or not. But anyway, he was a good old guy. So he bought the house, and he wasn't going to buy, didn't want the land. Only $150 for two lots. Gee, it was, you'd get $1,500 a lot for him now at the very least. Oh, more than that. You'd get $2,500 a lot now. But anyway, he didn't want it. So finally, Joe says, I'll buy the land. And the night before I left, I went over to see Joe and get paid for the land. And he says, well, now when I'm buying this land, he says, that old man's got to have, Harper Reed's has got to have that house off this winter or pay $25 a month rent for the land. I said, look, I said, I'm leaving here with a clean sheet and friends. And I said, I don't want any part of anything like that. So he had a would-be lawyer there with him. And his face got kind of red. And I walked out on him and went over to old Harper Reed to say so long. And he says, well, you got the money from Joe, eh? I said, I didn't. And he swore a little bit. And he went back in the back room and rattled a tin box around. He came out with $155, $5 to give to old John Williams, the liquor store man, to make out the paper. And he gave me, he said, here's something for you, Charlie. He had a big, heavy Indian sweater that he had bought for his brother. But he says, damn it, Charlie, he says, I think you're more worthy of it than anybody else. And he gave me this. And I was sure glad I had it that winter, because when you come to Vancouver from up north, it's dry up there, dry cold, and they felt the dampness. And I was a motorman, and I had to, when it was real foggy, I had to listen for sound, and I had the window open. You couldn't see any more than 8-10 feet ahead of you, and I had that heavy sweater on. It came in pretty handy. So I hope that it's of some interest to you, because old Joe was really quite a character. But I remember he got sick up there, and they got sent word to town, and I went up with the dogs to get him. And the undertaker was the one that came up with me to get him, of all people. But anyway, I got him in the sleigh, and he wouldn't let me hook the two dogs up because he said, they're too wild, I might get hurt. He figured it was his last. He told me all about how he stood and everything. And then finally got down the road a little bit. The other dog wanted to get in the harness, and he says, you better put the two of them in. So I did, and I had to stop every place going by all the old-timers, and he wanted to say goodbye to them all. He figured he was a goner, but he lived quite a while after that, but then he got drinking a bit, and that was, I guess, the end of it for old Joe. But that's Joe Unitas' history. Well, here it is another day, and I guess the election went the way we wanted it, although we didn't get a big enough majority, but a pretty good majority here in... So we got the progressive conservative, and we got free trade. So it was quite a night. I went to a dance, of course, last night. And I went to play cards. I usually play cards, but there was just 12 tables and one extra. So I said, well, I'll find something else to do. So I went to a dance, pretty good dance. And I was to a dance today again, so I'm trying to lose some of this weight. Anyway, I laughed. When I played this tape over, I spoke about shooting the grouse in the head just after I was sick, like for Ruth. But I must tell you, we were hunting ptarmigan one time, Dave and I, up there, and they were in Whitehorse at the time living. And so when I left to come down to Vancouver, I left a bunch of ptarmigan with them. And I said to Phyllis, that Dave's wife, I'm a bit of a joker anyhow, I said, well, now, Phyllis, I said, you used Dave's ptarmigan up, I said, first, because I said, they're probably shot anywhere. Dave was a good shot, really. He used a scope, and I didn't. But anyway, I said, use Dave's up first. I said, because mine will probably keep better. I said, mine are all shot in the head. Well, I knew darn well they were wild, you know, and you couldn't shoot them in the head. I wasn't that good a shot later anyhow, my sight. So she wrote me anyhow about a month after. She says, Dad, you know, she says, those were the funniest ptarmigan I ever cleaned. She says, they had their head in the funniest places you could ever believe. She's got a good sense of humor anyhow, too. Sure. So I was going to tell you more. I'm pretty nearly sure I told you another tape about the boat pulling the old boat out there for Nolan. But I'm going to mention about old Davy Hall again, the old chap that was out there from town that I mentioned off before, the old English chap. Well, when we left in 42, well, I'll go back a little further than that. Before I went out there to log, I'm going to draw a little sketch of his cabin so you'll see what lake it is. But anyway, before I went out there to log, he had some Swedes out there, and they built a big cabin. Oh, I'd say probably 24 by 28. I guess it's about right. 28 foot wide and 24 foot long. Big cabin. And he put a log cabin, put a wall down half of it. And so he just had roughly 14 foot wide, 14 by 24 or whatever it was. Anyhow, he had it cut in half. And he left the other half, and he would build onto it again sometimes. So he put a regular hip roof on it, the half. And for the ceiling, all they did was they took poles, and they hewed poles about 4 by 4, and they put them for the ceiling. And then he put a bunch of hay on top. Well, he had these darn cats, and he had a hole in the door for these cats. And oh, he had a dozen of them, it seemed. And them darn cats, the upstairs on the gable, it was open at both ends, just this hay, and them cats would go up in the hay, and they slept in the hay where it was warm. And of course, they wet in the hay, too, and then we had to have a good canvas over your bed. So that was pretty rough. That was the time I was telling you about when I cleaned the barn out, when he couldn't get the horses in for the hames. But anyway, stayed with him there. But, I had some other little things I was going to carry on about that there. I must have made a note here somewhere. Yes. Well, anyway, when we left there in 42, we went back up, and I saw him when I left, and he looked pretty rough. But we went back in 50, The poor old fellow, he'd been so crippled in that he cut all these walls down all around them for wood, and he had... at that time, the stove, the heater in the middle of the floor, had the front end of it had burnt out. And he was just shoving the wood in. He'd bring wood in six, 8 feet long and just shove it in as it burnt. Well, boy, oh boy, the poor fella, later on, I'm just a little ahead of myself. He carried on like that, and then he got in bad shape, and he was out here for a while, and he stayed with us. But he went back anyhow, and he... When we went back, I was 42, when we went back in 50, that's right, when we went back in 50, he was shoving the wood in there, and when we left in 42, the roof was leaking so bad that he had a tent over his bed so he wouldn't get wet when he's sleeping, just a little fly, and I'm damned if he didn't have that same tent over his bed in 1950. Well, shortly after that, I guess he was a little careless and shoving this wood, and the fire came out and burnt the floor and burnt the building down. And this Manny Magnuson was a wonderful chap. He went out with a few men and built a place for poor old Davy for the few years he has left. But he was sure a rugged old boy, old Davy. But I'll try and think of something more for you to get this tape to finish it off. I find it takes a little time. I have to sometimes back it up and go over it and get it straight. But I hope you can make it out at least anyhow, so I'll just shut off for now. Yes, Ian, it looks like the tape is just about the end, so you can run it right off to the end so you'll start the other side right. And I wish you the very best over Christmas and New Year's, and hopefully I'll get over there and see you in May for a little bit. Yes, in regard to... mentioning those two fellows, one shot the other accidentally, and the bear, it was, I've got the names backwards, it was Bert Bruner that climbed down the tree to save Tom Webb, and it was Tom Webb that shot Bert Bruner all right after. And I noticed, for anybody in Atlin hearing this tape, it was, speaking of Mr. Nelson, in regard to the people that hung the man below Juno, the unexpected story, when he came to Atlin, he worked on Birch Creek with this Jack Johnson first, and he was over on Spruce after, mind a little, and then he had the store. So I hope that will clear things up for anybody that Here's this tape. I don't think there's any old-timers living that remember them, but just in case there might be, why, I thought I'd better get it straight.
Yes, I remember. Well, folks, this is... pardon me. This is Monday, September... Monday the 13th of September. I'm here to put a 60-minute tape here. I put on a 60-minute tape for you folks, and I realize I'm putting it on to a 90. So I've got to add a little to it to sort of finish it off. And this tape that you have just heard was made in 1988 for this Ian McIntosh that was searching the family tree on account of his grandmother and my grandmother were sisters of Archibald Leed of Leed's Shipping in London, as you probably know by now. So I'm just going to do the best I can to fill this in. I've also made a tape here, a 30-minute tape here on a trip to Birch Creek, and I've got the other side here, 30 minutes, and I'll maybe have to do a little rustling around to give you some more tales of the North or tales of people in the North. And as I said before, this Margaret Evans, she's married to Smith, and she hasn't been too well, and I want to get her up because I've got all kinds of old-time pictures here of, as I said, the Atlin trip. We made a trip once a year to the Ben McCree when the boats were going. We even went with the old Scotia in the early days there too. And there's so many of these old timers that we can pick them out individually and give a little history on them, because there was some great ones. All right, now if I can think of this old George Adams, he was a half brother to Jack Garrett that had the store in there, and he was quite a guy. He used to figure he could tell about as good line as anybody. And he one time he was telling about he was cutting ice down there. They used the old whipsaws to cut ice those days, and blocks, and we stored them. In fact, we stored ice over there where the hospital is, or the glaciology people are over there now. There used to be an old brewery over there, and we stored ice over there in sawdust. Old Louis Schultz did, and the town people go over and dig ice out of there too. But anyway, George Adams was cutting ice down there this one time, and it was snowing quite heavy, and Fuller came out, a tourist, and he says, "Geez, as you cut like two men." George Adams says, "Well," he says, "there is two men. I got another fella down below." This tourist was a real greenhorn. And so they talking away for a little bit, and George stopped a bit, and he says, "Well," he says, "I better get going again." He says, "Why?" He says, "That fellow will be coming up from below." But it just happened, just about that time, old John Roxburgh, the old granddad Roxburgh, he came out to get some water, and it was snowing so much he didn't notice where it was cut cakes. And Jesus, he steps on the cakes, and he goes down, of course, and he starts cursing to beat the dickens. George says, "There he is. I told you he'd be coming up pretty soon." Well, he was quite a character. But anyway, there was some wonderful people in those days. I had quite a life. I worked with my dad when he had he had what they call Gerrans's Canyon up there. I think Rudy staked it up later. It was above Nolan's, but it was off to the side. And poor Dad, the way that got called Gerrans's Canyon, Dad had a fellow by the name of Charlie Brown. And Charlie Brown was down at Tron Gulch there, and then he was down there below Colma Lake later years. But in the early days, Charlie was around, and Dad had Charlie up there as a sort of a partner. And Charlie was to... Dad had had a prospect just below that hill, and it was just on hardpan, I'm sure, speaking as a miner's term. It wasn't bedrock, but he'd got this prospect, and he thought it was good, so he wanted to bring the creek through. The creek used to run around that big hill, and he had Charlie go up there to drive a tunnel through, and Dad said, "You keep that tunnel boarded up solid with lumber," and he had the lumber there to handle the creek. And Charlie Brown, he took and he didn't put a stick of lumber in it, and he went ahead, and finally he broke through and the creek came through. So that's how that canyon is there, that they call Gerrans's Canyon. Well, then, of course,
when the creek broke through there and brought all that dirt down, it covered it up, Dad's prospect, so deep that he never did. They tried fooling around a bit, but he never did get to it. He had different fellas take a lay on it, and he grub staked them and everything, but nothing came of it. But it didn't amount to anything anyhow. It was the wrong place for the pay because it was further over, as Eastman and them had it. But it sort of ran out there. My personal opinion is that the glacier came down and it just cut everything out, and it just raised there. It raised there and left the pay below. It's almost like Gold Run. That's why the either that or there's a fall ahead, because when the Matsons worked the last, why, they ran into loose gravel. They lost the bedrock altogether, so it indicate a fall ahead. But I'm not a geologist, but I know this much. I'm quite sure that when the glacier came down Surprise Lake, it Surprise Lake out, and the old-timers will tell you that no, and different people, that when it cut the end right off of Boulder Creek and Birch Creek and Ruby Creek, because we started in Consolidated started in 1926. They started down on Boulder Creek, and they started down from the lake there, and they thought they'd get this pay below the where Charlie Miller, he and some people had an incline up above quite a ways, about a mile above or more above the. And they went down 40 feet or less, and they got bedrock. Well, Consolidated came up as flat as they could, and I worked there myself a couple of years. I think they had 4 inches to a 12-foot box. That's what it was. And we had a 70-foot bank, and there was no bedrock, and they had bedrock at 12 feet ahead, at 40 feet ahead. So we ran in, and then we put a straight, we hit the straight rim of rock, and they put a raise in, and they went in along on top, and The old-timers were just lucky enough. They were just, they weren't 50 feet above the cutoff. And when I drilled for outfits up there, and when I drilled Birch Creek, I had the same thing. It would be about 18 feet to bedrock, and I came down below, and I went down 80 feet, and there was no bottom at all. We just give up. It was just quicksand. So I feel that the glacier came down. Another thing that makes me feel about it, there was a chap, years ago, Frank Henning was driving for Schultz with an old Cadillac, and this fellow, Louis Harris was his name, and Louis Harris, he wanted to go up. He'd been there in the early days, just below what they call Number 4 Gate. There's a little lake there, and Louis Harris had been in the early days there, and he'd gone back, and he put a shaft down there, 80 feet, and never got any bedrock, and he showed Frank Henning and I that. So I kind of had an idea that there was something up there. And the outfit that worked on Gold Run that got such good pay on the high, well, they got a rim, more pay on the rim than the bottom, which we found out after. But they came up, and they lost the bedrock. Well, I more or less knew that ahead of time, and I told Alan Matson that, but he didn't believe me. That was my old partner. But that's some of the experience that I've had, and what little knowledge I have of mining, although I didn't make anything mining myself. I did a little on Birch Creek and did fairly well with old Frank Brown the 1 year. I should have gone back the next year, but Dad wanted me up on Blue Canyon. And I think in this book that you will have there, there's a picture of myself and an old chap, Matt Gustafson, and my dad. And that's when I went up on Geringer's Canyon instead of going with Brown. And I'm saying this right now. I know it'll be hard for people to believe, but Frank Brown, he knew that anything I got was, there'd be nothing taken away from him, and he offered me 60% the second year to go back with him. I got the third the first year, but I know the old chap. When I would go up after supper, he was quite crippled and he had two canes to walk, and I'd go up and pull the rocks back. We were ground sluicing on the top, on the side hill there. And I got about a half ounce, I found about a half ounce nugget before we ever got mining there to speak of. And I showed it to him, and he was sure quite happy. And I'm sure old Frank was a rough old chap, and he'd mined a nugget point in the real early days. And he'd been to Peace River after that and had a native woman, I guess, and he drank a little. But boy, He didn't cheat me out of a cent. I don't believe to this day. And he was a fine old man. And I saw him when he was... I went over to Victoria one time, and I found out he was in the rest home there, Catholic rest home, right near the Parliament buildings. I went over to see him. I must tell you this. And I didn't know he was alive, and I was so surprised. And he was over 90, I think, at that time. And so I went over to see him, and he didn't quite recognize me for a little bit. He was quite deaf, but he was well-dressed. He had to leave Atlin because he couldn't look after himself, and they sure looked after him over at this Catholic home there. A nice suit on and everything. He took Ruth and I had Ruth with me, my wife, and he took us upstairs and showed us his place and one thing another. And before I was leaving, I said to him, "Well, Frank," I said, "How do you get a little drink?" I said, "Here," I said, "I'll give you," and I gave him $10. And he put that in his pocket and shoved it in his pocket. I can remember him so well. A big smile came on his face. "Well," he says, "I'll look after that good." He says, "You know, I had a couple of dollars before," and he said, "We have a regular park where we can sit away and get away from things." And he said, "We had a Mickey over there," and he said, "We were having a drink or two," and he said, "One of the nurses, well, she'd be a nun, I guess, I don't know her, the nurses anyhow, came around, and she says, "Well, Mr. Brown," she says, "we'll administer that for medical purposes." And he says, "Hell," he says, "that there," he says, "that wouldn't be any good to me," he says, "this time," he says, "with this $10, he says, I'll work it a little better." Well, he was quite a character. But he was so interested in John Nolan, you see, had just started about the time he left to come out. And he said, "By golly," he said, "Charlie," he said, "I want to find out about John Nolan." He said, "If anybody ever deserved to make it, he did." Well, old John, he did, but he sure worked hard. I guess I shouldn't jump from things so much, but I listened to this program of Barley's here, and he just yesterday, I guess it was, on from Victoria, and he had the history of Atlin. Well, I've met Bill one time, and he wanted me to give him a little history of there. I think I'll have to, because he spoke of Mrs. Noland hoisting the dirt up, how Noland went down over 100 feet or 150 feet, and Mrs. Noland hoisted the dirt up, and while John put the shaft down. Well, folks, I was with John pretty well through the very start of that. And I was with him when he started in, and the men quit him. He got down 50 feet, I think, on the lower shaft, 50 or 60 feet or better. And they ran into quicksand, and they couldn't hold it, they figured. So they all quit him. And old Matthews, he was backing them gambling. He figured Nolan would make it. And they boys, they were supposed to get... They were getting $7 a day and board. And if they waited till it got down to the pay, they would get $9 on board. Well, Matthews, when they quit him, Matthews bought all their time at $7 a day. So I went with Nolan, and we worked the rest of the winter and got that through into Hardpan so that he could carry on. But the reason I didn't stay with Nolan, I couldn't afford to take a chance having the wife and two kids. I bought my groceries from Nolan that winter, from Matthews that winter. I bought my groceries from Matthews, and I had to turn my time in to pay for the groceries. Well, after working all winter, say for instance I had 100 days, well, that would be 900 if I could wait for it, but I had to cash in Matthews for $7, and he charged me a pretty good price for the groceries, so it left me just $100 for the winter, and that's when I went to Birch Creek, and you'll see on the tape, this tape that I've got from Birch Creek, it gives the history of what money we had. I think we had $4 over when we paid for our share of the groceries to go up there as partners. But anyway, well, I think I'll just cut this off for a minute so I'll see if I can think of something a little better. Well, I guess this is going to be a little different now. I'm going to give you a little change here for people that don't know me too well and may be kind of curious about myself. Well, I left Atlin in 42 because I wanted the boys to get an education, which I didn't get. And Ruth came out just a little ahead of us and flew out with Peterson. And I came out after I'd cut some lagging up on timber. I had to cut up for lagging to sell. It was hard to get rid of timber at that time. So I came to Vancouver. And I was hoping to get on a shipyard or something, but I met a fellow that I used to know, and he was working for the BC Electric, and he said after the First World War, he said the shipyards were no good, go to work for the BC Electric. So I went to the BC Electric and I went up to see them, and this social insurance was on at that time or something, and you couldn't get a job without going through social insurance. They wanted people in the woods and everything. Well, I didn't want to go to the woods, so I went up and saw this chap, and I remember it was Harold Till, and he says, well, if you'd social insurance didn't send you up, I said, I can't talk to you. Well, I was pretty easy going. I was 32 then. I said, well, I said, I don't know, you're talking to me now. And I said, you'd have a hard time throwing me out, you know. I said, I think I don't want to talk to you. He says, you know, he said, there's something about you. He was a nice chap. He said, something about you. He said, I think you and I can get along pretty good. I kind of laughing, you know. He says, here, he says, I'll give you the forms. I shouldn't tell you this, but he said, give me the forms. He says, you fill them out. And he said, you go up to this social security, or not social security, but it was in connection with work, at least, it had to be through the government. And he says, you go in and see them. I can't think of the name of it right now. But he says, you go in and see them at exactly 2 o'clock and ask for Mr. Brown and say you're looking for a job and wonder if you could get something with the BC Electric. And he says, I'll phone in just about right at the time. So he phoned in, and I went in just at 2 o'clock, and Mr. Brown says, funny, I got a call. He says, they're going to hire a few men. So I was the first man hired in 43, and I was hired before I ever went up there. But anyway, well, I stayed with them to 51. Well, I first was a motorman, and pardon me, I was a conductor first. And I don't know, it seemed to be keeping track of the change. There was so much change and not handling money, and I was pretty short money and worried to meet Dickens because I had been out in the Depression. I worried about the money a bit, and I would go home at night, and poor Ruth would hear me clicking these quarters off and wake her up. And anyway, I changed hands and ends, and I was a motorman after that for a while, and then I went on the buses. And I liked working alone better. When you had a conductor, he was always giving you 4 bells to keep going. I didn't want to pick people up, and sometimes you'd work what they call the belt line. And when you worked the belt line, I had 1 or 2 conductors, and one of them in particular, and he had $50 to work with, but he had it all spent all the time, and he'd working on about $15-$20, and he'd have to stop every time he went up Main Street past the barns. He had to run in and get an extra $10 worth of tickets or so. So it kept you on the jump a bit. So I went on the buses, and but I couldn't see any future in it, and I left the buses, and I tried to go into, well, I did, I went into trucking with a dump truck, and it was a little bit rough. The first job I went on, I went up the coast, and I worked in the city some, but I went up the coast in a logging job, and I came back $700 in the hole, and I sprung a frame and one thing and another, but Ruth, in the meantime, had got a job working, and then I got straightened up, and I got a fairly good break in trucking. I was kind of conscious, all right, nothing like to give them a good day's work, and I did find fairly well. I had no trouble with work. I worked steady towards the later years. I worked from I started in 51, and I quit in 55, and that's 14 years, and I just sold the truck, and I figured Ruth and I could get along, and so we went back. Ruth was originally from Charlottetown, and we went back east and spent the summer back east and went to north then to see Dave in Dawson. My youngest boy was working in Dawson at that time. He was a mining recorder in Dawson. So I've had a fairly active life all right enough. And of course then we traveled, as I say, 65 and 66 we moved north, and when poor Ruth got in 68, she was getting arthritis quite bad, and she died in February the 9th, 1969. But I had a wonderful, she was a wonderful person, and while I was starting to truck at that time, and they had a census come up here, and she wrote the exam for the census. Well, she'd had a good education and was quite good at accounting, and so she worked for the census, and before the census was over, the income tax had been looking around for somebody, and they checked her up, and they asked her if she'd go to work for the income tax. So she worked 1 month shy of 5 years for the income tax, and she could have stayed another month and got a month's pay, but we wanted to get away on a trip, and glad we did. I would have had her quit and quit working myself sooner if I'd known, but I wanted to. Being as I'd had all that sickness in the early days, what would be about 34 or 35 with rheumatic fever, I figured that Ruth would outlive me by 20 years, and I was wanted to see her through and have enough for her, so I had a little bit, and I've managed to get along all right. I've spent a little money, gambled a little bit a few times, foolishly, in the stock market, but I'm here, and I think I can get by. I think if I had to borrow any money, I think my son, older boy, would gladly finance me, but I'm not buying anything. I'm living in an apartment and quite content where I am. And I do all my own jam, and I went up to the Okanagan again this fall, and I bought 60 pounds of peaches and 40 pounds of pears and a bunch of plums and a box of apples, and I did 21 quarts of peaches and 14 of pears, and I made plum jam and gave the plums away. There's a lot of folks in this building. There's 42 suites, and I've been here 18 years, and I know a lot of folks, and I'm glad to. I get a lot of pleasure out of giving fruit out to people, and we've got a good relationship, and very fortunately I'm on the second floor on the high side of the building, and I can put out tomatoes, and I had tomatoes over 2 pounds last year, but they didn't quite that good this year, but I've got tomatoes for everybody in the building and quite a few other people as well, so I don't eat that many, but I've got now that I've got accustomed to them, and I kind of enjoy them a little bit right off the vine when they're ripe. But it's been a poor year this year, a lot of rain, and we did get a little blight on them. So that's a little more of what I'm doing right now. I was up this year, as you know, and I definitely think I will go back next year. If I go back, if I have to buy a second-hand truck and a camper or a little motorhome or something, because I'd like to have a place of my own that I can stop. I find this bed and breakfast place, although it's one in Atlin, isn't bad, this Willow or whatever they call it, up at the old Epton house. I think I wouldn't mind staying there a bit, but when you pay around $60 or better a night for bed and breakfast, it runs a little high. I guess I probably might be able to bend my pocketbook, I'm going to have a transportation of my own, because when my son Harry was up there this year with a big trailer and a friend, and Dave was up there, my younger boy, I've just got the two boys, and they really enjoyed it. And Harry went to the McBride Museum and I think it was the Yukon Archives and around, and he checked someplace, he told me. I didn't get a chance to talk to him much since he came back, but he checked someplace there under G for Gairns, and apparently they'd got a lot of history about us from my sister, and they had some pictures of me running the mail with dogs and one thing another, and I did meet a lady there in Atlin this summer. See now if I can find, Diane Christholm or something like that, and she was connected with them a bit, and I gave her one of the letters that I had written to my cousin about my little history, and she turned it in. I've got a letter from them, and that's why I'm doing this tape. I'm sending everything to them, and they would like to get some more data, I guess, on the North and what happened. So I hope that it'll be of benefit or reasonable listening to some of you folks some evening or something like that. You can. I don't know whether here in Vancouver and Burnaby, you can get these tapes from the library, and it's possible they might just put that tape in the library for you. There'll be two tapes. There'll be one on the trip to Birch Creek, which is a very good tape, with my partner speaking, John Backlund, who was in Atlin. Some of you people that hear this will know of John, and he was a wonderful chap. And I had the two Matson boys partners, too. But I'll just take and see what I can do. And there may be a little more on this tape, and I'll scare up something just to fill it. I just don't want to send you a lot of blank tape, although probably might be better if it was blank than my stories. But anyway, the best to you for now, and I'm just going to shut it off for a minute.